Welcome to the Gospel Rain podcast, part of the teaching ministry of Dr. Matt Brown and Dr. Micah Carter. We're glad you've joined us today for gospel-centered conversations of two like-minded pastors who want to see the gospel of Christ reign in the hearts of God's people. We would love to hear your feedback and your questions. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/gospelrain or go to @gospelrain on Twitter. We hope you will find gospel-centered answers to your questions about theology and the Christian life. And now, we welcome you to the Gospel Rain conversation.
Welcome back to Gospel Rain. It's great to be back after just a little hiatus. In fact, we are currently at a pastor's study. It's actually called the Deep South Pastor's Study. And the vision behind it was to get guys from, I don't know, four or five southern states to come together and to take a book of the Bible and to get a scholar who's written a commentary and spend some time with that scholar for the purpose of growing in our knowledge of the book, but also application practically to preach the book. And so we're here this week in Jackson, Mississippi, to study the book of Acts with Dr. Eckhard Schnabel, who wrote a commentary in the Zondervan Exegetical Series. And so I think there's 20-plus pastors here, and most of us are from Mississippi. But one pastor has traveled probably the longest distance to come be with us, and that's Mark Marshall from Mount Juliet, Tennessee. Mark is the senior pastor of the Glade Church in Mount Juliet. He is my former pastor when I was in Franklin, Tennessee, and still is one of the top three pastors most influential in my life. And he's married to Leanne, wonderful lady. They have two daughters and one granddaughter.
That's right.
Selah.
Selah.
And how old?
Selah is just over 6 months
okay,
old now.
6 months. So you're a very happy grandfather.
Granddad.
Yeah, granddad.
Like,
that's right.
New season of life.
New season of life. And, you know, one of the reasons why we wanted to sit down with Mark is because he's been in ministry 30-plus years and a good pastor. Man, I will say that genuinely as I've observed you over the last, I don't know, coming up on a decade, I guess.
Yeah, almost 10 years.
You know, just the application of pastoral ministry through a life built on expository preaching, solid leadership, biblical godly leadership, and you know all of that comes together, and I've observed that in your ministry. So we wanted to sit down with you and take a few minutes to maybe just have a conversation, Matt, if we could.
Yeah, sounds good.
About, you know, four or five, maybe six things that affect the church today. So we got three pastors sitting here. What's on our minds and what's the church facing as we seek to lead churches in the 21st century? Yep. So let me just throw out, I'll just throw out one, and you guys will probably have others you want to bring to bear as we talk together. But I think one issue, Mark, if you might help us think through this today, is church at large. Okay, maybe not necessarily our specific churches, but the church at large seems to have maybe difficulty with gospel clarity. And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation in the last 5 to 8 years, maybe more, on gospel centrality and the gospel movement, gospel everything. But do we understand the gospel better in our churches, and how are churches clarifying, you know, you could take us into mission, you could take us into preaching, whatever you want to do. But would you say that one of the issues, major issues affecting the church is, man, we're not as clear as we need to be on the gospel itself.
I would definitely say it's one of the issues we're dealing with. And it does affect mission. It affects people's motivation as to why they even want to be on mission, live on mission. It affects people's ability to, or the confidence in the gospel personally. So am I saved? Am I not saved? Which takes away a lot of the confidence from being able to share the gospel, being able to feel like I'm equipped to be able to do that. And so, absolutely, I think we've done probably a disservice. I think I've been doing this long enough now. I can say we did a disservice, have done a disservice over the last several decades anyway, of discipling our people to understand what it is they've been called to. So it's following Christ. What does that mean? How do I live that out every day? How does that affect the lens through which I look at everything in the world, all the issues that are going on, some of the things that we'll bring up here in a few minutes have to do with whether or not I really understand what it means to have this relationship with Christ, mm-hmm. to be a follower of Christ, and how that plays itself out in my marriage, how it plays itself out at work. How does the gospel impact so many different areas in my life? And mm-hmm. because we have failed in the area of discipleship, I think that's led to this real misunderstanding and a lack of clarity around the gospel.
Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking some earlier before the podcast about how the issue, and you just mentioned it a second ago in passing, about the issue of assurance of salvation mm-hmm. and how that's a really big issue in churches right now. At least it has been where I am and in my ministry for 20 years. It's been an issue. People will come up to me and ask me or sit down in my office and say, I'm not sure that I'm saved. I'm not sure. And as you're talking about gospel clarity, do you think that's a result? Do you think that may be part of the result of maybe us not communicating the gospel clearly, or not communicating it enough, or not what might be the root of maybe some of that lack of assurance with some people?
Yeah, I think we've come out of a period of time when church growth was it was the flag that everybody flew, mm-hmm. and because of that. Not intentionally, but we tended to dumb down the gospel to make it a decision that you make, and that's kind of it. And so we never went any further because basically we kind of got them all to the pool and dropped them off and mm-hmm. said, man, got to go get some more, which is not a bad thing. Evangelism should be our heartbeat, but when we have not grown up our folks and what it means to be a true follower of Christ, that has definitely had an impact on how effective we can be in terms of getting the mission done, getting the assignment done, because we simply don't understand the assignment, what it really means for me to be a follower of Christ. And so this lack of certainty and assurance in my salvation has created, I think, an army of people who simply are not confident in their faith. Mm. And if I'm not confident in my faith, I'm not going to go across the street and tell my neighbor.
That's right. It affects a lot of things, doesn't it?
Exactly. I'm sure not going to get on an airplane and fly to the other side of the world. I don't even understand why that's necessary
if I don't understand the
gospel.
I just recently heard somebody say that a guy came to him and told him that he's been a Christian for 22 years, but he's not a 22-year-old Christian. He's a 1-year-old Christian for 22 years consecutively.
Yeah.
And that he's never really taken from the moment of conversion that kind of growth into, and maybe we're talking about gospel clarity in what is the gospel, but also the application of that,
right?
You know, in all of life, like you mentioned, marriage and finances and other things. But gospel clarity, you know, and so we come from a tradition, Baptist tradition, that is largely, or at least in the last maybe 50 years or so, largely revivalistic and right. pressing programmatic kind of, models in the church that, like you're saying, kind of you get people saved, I guess is the terminology. You get people saved, baptized, but then we're still on a campaign to get more people saved, more people baptized.
Right.
Which is a major metric in our tribe, baptism, major metric. But then what's happening to those people who are saved? Do they ever really understand the gospel to which they've been called, and how does that affect their lives?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that's what, you're saying, that necessarily is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Revivalism, getting people in the pews, getting them saved. But I agree with you. I think we along the way for so long, maybe we've stopped short of a real discipleship process. We get them saved and then, sort of drop them. Good luck. Glad you're here, but, we don't know what else to do with you, or we're not going to intentionally do anything else with you. Good luck, and we hope you'll grow, that kind of thing. But there's not been a lot of maybe intentional discipleship after the fact.
Right, and if there's no intentional discipleship, and if I do not understand the gospel, if I don't have clarity around the gospel, and I won't feel like I'm equipped to be able to share that faith. I don't know, we as our tribe, as you referred to, Micah, baptisms, we're all, you know, it can get easy to get discouraged. Baptisms have dropped and that sort of thing in our denomination. Well, we've sort of done this to ourselves. We've not equipped people in their faith to understand what it means to be a follower, to be passionate, to understand really what is this gift that I have received. And if I understand that gift, I cannot stop talking about that. I cannot not share my faith. And we tend to swing that pendulum one way or the other. It's all about evangelism or it's all about discipleship. Those two fit hand in glove. I don't know a stronger way to say that. Those two really are the same thing. In so many ways, they're. I realize, you know, growing a Christian, sanctification is definitely, you know, definitely the next step. But we really have sort of separated the two as if they are two different deals. In fact, I served at the same institution you did at Lifeway for a period of time, and when I was there and responsible for training, along with our states, almost every state had a separate evangelism guy and discipleship guy. And so we siloed the two as if they did not belong together. And so the whole gospel clarification, understanding what that is, somehow we got to come back and marry those, or our adults simply are not, they're not sharing their faith because they're not confident in their faith.
That's good.
You know, I think it was John Metter, pastor in Texas, and David Platt who took the word gospel and made an acronym. I found it very helpful. I've actually preached through this acronym gospel that we're trying to clarify what do we mean by this biblically. And so Ephesians 2, kind of as a foil against which to talk about that, God's character and the offense of sin, sufficiency of Christ, personal response, eternal urgency, and life transformation, all of that flows together. And really, I think it's important that you get to life transformation, because that is where discipleship kind of flourishes. And like you're saying, you know, we should have never divorced those two concepts.
Right.
You know, good news is the making of disciples.
Yeah.
Mark, you actually were appointed to a task force, discipleship task force, in the Southern Baptist Convention. You sit on that with other guys and have probably looked at a lot of numbers and metrics and patterns and stuff, and probably have brought some reports to, you know, our denomination about what the current status of discipleship and maybe what we can do to improve. Tell us a little bit about that work, and then, you know, because I think if we're lacking gospel clarity, maybe a second issue affecting the church, and we've kind of been dancing around this, is poor discipleship in general. Just, you know... And I think maybe for a lot of people are thinking, well, we communicate information. Isn't that discipleship? Well, no, it's not really. Talk to us about that.
Not really discipleship. I'm Robbie Gallaty, the pastor at Long Hollow Baptist Church in Hendersonville, Tennessee, is the he's the captain of that ship. He's the guy who's leading our team. And so about a year and a half ago, I was appointed to be on that team and honored to do so. And as we're talking about this, one of the key concepts, I think, for us is really a lead measure against lag measures. And lag measures are things like baptisms. So we measure that. It's pretty easy to count those. But how do we get to that, and what are those lead measures that we're doing? So, for example, the more people that I am pouring my life into, investing into in terms of discipleship, holding them accountable, those kinds of things. Those are really difficult things. It's not difficult in the terms of numbers of folks that I'm discipling, but it's difficult to measure. Yeah. So what is a disciple?
Right.
And definitely one of the things we believe Scripture teaches is a disciple is someone who multiplies themselves.
Right.
They are a disciple maker.
Yeah.
And so we obviously have not created those. We haven't built those as we have failed to invest in these folks and to get them to that place. So this task force is trying to work on kind of a way to spark this across the convention in a way that is not programmatic. Mm-hmm. So imagine trying to do that across 47,000
yeah.
churches.
Right.
We don't want this to be a program. That is definite. We don't want this just to be a curriculum of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're trying to think through is how can we help church leaders think through things to measure that may be a little different than the things we have measured in the past.
Yeah.
Again, our tribe fills out this annual church profile, and
yeah.
we don't know where that's going to go in terms of mm-hmm. whether or not we can put something in the annual church profile. It kind of, you get what you measure, right?
Right?
And so we're trying to figure out what can we put in there. That's one approach we're taking along with just some definitions. So as an example, in the past, I worked at Lifeway.
Mm-hmm.
When you talked about discipleship from Lifeway, you typically talked about curriculum, programs, things that came in boxes and you'd send out, and we'd all get together on Sunday afternoons and just kind of a information dissemination was what
right.
discipleship was.
Right.
And so we've tried to think through that in a way that now it's more about life transformation. How do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
It's much more life on life, accountability, those kinds of things that we're looking at trying to help people understand, define terms. So a disciple, by definition, multiplies themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If we can truly get that in the bloodstream mm-hmm. of Southern Baptist, you can see a difference in baptisms.
Yeah.
And a difference in the results that we get in terms of a lag measure
mm-hmm.
in the baptism, which is what we all tend to focus on.
Well, I think
on.
That's one of the common misnomers in the churches is that when you ask people, are you making disciples, are you doing discipleship as a church, they automatically will say, yeah, we've got a discipleship
right.
training
right.
thing,
yeah.
Yeah. or we do training union, or whatever term you want to call it. Yeah, we've got that. We mm-hmm. we do that as if that's a program that we have, or we mark that, we can check that box and say we're doing discipleship. But I'm afraid, not to say that that's not part of discipleship, that's a good thing, and I'm not knocking it. I'm just
yeah.
simply saying I think a lot of times we think as a corporate body, as long as we got a few people showing up for discipleship training, our church is okay, we're doing discipleship.
Right.
And I think that may be a sort of a common misnomer, at least in my mind and in churches I pastored before. Now, I've been just as guilty before thinking, okay, we've got that covered. But it's more than that. It's bigger than that. It's not just a, like you're talking about, it's not just a class that you're having. It's a real personal understanding
mm-hmm.
of my responsibility
right.
as a Christian to multiply, to make another disciple, so that that disciple would then go make another disciple. It's supposed to be more of a personal thing rather than just a corporate class
right.
that we're having for 10 people.
Mm. One of the things we've done in our church is we've set up 6 measures that we kind of survey our people on from time to time. One of the questions, one of the measures is how many people, or the question is actually, are you investing spiritually in someone else?
Mm.
Now, what we do is we give our parents permission to say yes if they are actually investing spiritually in their child. In other words, if they're intentional, that's another great word around
mm-hmm.
discipleship. If they're being intentional and pouring their life into the child spiritually, we know they are as parents, and they're
mm-hmm.
teaching them how to throw a curveball. And
that's right.
And
but it's more than just praying over dinner.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. It is. Am I teaching my child the gospel?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do that. Are they from the age they can begin to understand and age appropriate and all the things like that, and there's some tools out there to help with that.
Mm-hmm.
Am I leading my child through that in a way that they begin to understand, and I'm investing as a parent, I'm investing in their lives spiritually, intentionally doing so to raise up disciple makers.
Wow. Yeah. So yeah, we heard something today in our study time that I've just kind of been pondering for a little while, and it was related to China and the growth of Christianity in China. Without pastors, because many of them were in prison, but the movement of the church underground, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
flourishing because disciples were making disciples.
Right.
And so I guess, you know, and here's the irony of this for me, I guess, Mark, is, and I know you have other metrics you want to talk about in your church, but if we've disseminated so much information over time, then how do our people not feel more equipped to pass on the gospel to somebody else, you know, and you know, is that laid at the feet of pastors? Is it laid at the feet of, you know, the system and structure of the church or whatever? I'm not sure, because it's flourishing elsewhere, and I don't know if the American church is, you know, if what would happen if we were in the same scenario?
Let me what we heard today, and I just because the statistics stuck with me, is that earlier in the 1900s there were about 10 million Christians in China, and then at some point later on, around before World War II, all the missionaries, Christian missionaries, were ousted from China.
Yeah. Yeah.
No missionaries left. No pastors, at least visible pastors, were left. That was against the law. You could not do that. Mm-hmm. And now there's over 100 million Christians, which is incredible that all of that happened without the missionaries there, or without the, I guess, the vocational missionaries there, without the pastors visibly pastoring the church. It happened because of people, common Christian people making disciples.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
that's
helpful. That was incredible for me to hear that same statistic you heard.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think part of it, when you talk to the average Christian, I'll just say, when I've talked to the average Christian, the Great Commission they see as something that is handed to the church as an institution.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Commission was not something that was given to them personally.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't own that personally because it speaks of going to the ends of the earth.
Yeah.
Well, I don't travel. I don't go
That's
to the ends
me.
Of the
That's
earth.
Not me.
Exactly.
That's not my
thing.
Yeah.
Somebody else. We pay money. Yeah. Missionaries go do that. And so that is that's one of the ways we've made a big mistake is not teaching the Great Commission as this is for each of us and having responsibility. And a story about China just kind of brought that back to my mind today.
Yeah.
That I don't know that we really bought into this is for each of us, all of us.
Absolutely. And those people are under incredible persecution too.
Yeah.
They're doing it all under persecution, which is interesting. Yeah. Can I shift gears?
Absolutely.
Let me mention another issue that's big right now. All three of us sitting around the table in our makeshift studio as we're here in this retreat, all three of us have a cell phone. Most everybody that I know that I pastor sits with a cell phone in the pew, and sometimes I wonder how many people are on Facebook or Twitter or
Candy
Snapchat
Crush.
Or doing Candy Crush or doing something while I'm preaching, something like that. But one of the big things right now in church is social media. A lot of people are constantly. And I've been guilty of that too before. I've really sort of tried to cut back. I'm not on social media as much as I was in the past. But it's a huge thing for people in the pews. And I'm wondering how much of an issue that is for the body of Christ right now. Is that Mark, do you see that as a big distraction? A positive, a negative? How do you see social media? I know it can be both, but how do you see that as it's shaking out right now in the church?
Mm-hmm.
And it can be both. And unfortunately, what I see is a lot of Christians making statements. And when you got Christians that are undiscipled making statements in a public forum, we're shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of trying to share the gospel.
Mm. Yeah.
A lot of anger. We came through a very difficult year in terms of the election.
Right.
During the
That's
election,
yeah.
I had folks, and I'm sure you guys did too, I had folks in my church on both sides in terms of who they were going to vote for.
Yeah.
And they were not afraid to express a lot of opinions that had absolutely no biblical foundation as to why they would say those things. So I found myself having to kind of cut some people off.
Right.
Just don't need to see that anymore. So you take the election year, but then take it beyond that is, unfortunately, again, I see a lot of folks that claim to be Christ followers who are on social media whose news feed on their social media looks just like everybody else's or their page, their personal page, where they're putting some things out there. It looks like what everybody else is putting out there as well. I do think we're all terribly distracted by social media right now. I just came off 2.5 weeks of vacation. I cut everything off during that 2.5 weeks vacation. I cannot tell you what that did to my mood personally, to stay away.
I can imagine.
Don't look at the stuff and don't put anything out there.
Yeah.
So it's a both and, because the other side of that, flip side of that coin, as a pastor, it allows me to be able to communicate with a lot of people in my church.
That's right.
And you can use it for good. You can use it for the gospel, but you also just build relationships with people. I can walk in before a service on Sunday morning, often I know about the issues that somebody in front of me, I'm about to shake their hand, I saw yesterday that they asked for prayer for so-and-so.
Right, right.
And so it does help me engage that.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy, we've got to be careful in terms of just how we measure the time spent there and what we are saying as Christians. We are screaming right now into a megaphone.
Yeah. And, you know, someone recently I heard this phrase, keyboard courage, you know, that people are saying things and they'll make statements offensive, wounding statements.
Yeah.
And I dare say they wouldn't say that to your face.
Right. Yeah, it's almost anonymity.
Yeah. It's almost like a weird protection behind, you know, and, you know, what's funny about Facebook, for example, is they'll expose all this stuff about their personal life.
Right.
And it's like, why in the, who are you showing this?
Yeah. Nobody wants to know
we're
that.
We're looking at this.
Are you really recommending that movie? Are you really going to do that? Be
right.
there? Go yeah. with that?
Yeah,
right.
No,
that's
so.
Right.
Yeah, and then like you said, on the other side of the coin, what an opportunity to, because it's not meant to. Even though Facebook, if you took all the people, would be like the third largest country in the world, and whatever the statistics are, meant to be its own community. And I think even Zuckerberg has even tipped his hat to, you know, this is church for people. I mean, this is you know, replacement of church. And. And so people are looking at, they have a community, but it's virtual and it's digital, and
it's not
rubbing elbows and sharing coffee and, you know, I'm with you, I'm praying with you, you know, the kind of Romans 12.
I think that's a big thing that has really 13, changed because of all the social media, is the lack of personal FaceTime, one-on-one conversation with people. And I think as much as a good thing as it can be to connect with people, because that's where as a pastor, I find out where half my people are.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, they're at a ball game, or they've gone on vacation, or they're at the hospital, or whatever. I find out on Facebook, you know, and then I can follow up, so it can be a good thing. But one of the negative things I've seen about it, not only is what you can read and what you can see and all the offensive things, is the fact that it can be such a time waster.
For sure.
And you're not careful. You can scroll through for 45 minutes and just have wasted your time reading nothing, really. Yeah. And I know that feeling, because there are times I do it too. I've scrolled through and I look up and it's 45 minutes later. I'm going, what have I done for the last four? I've wasted my time when I could have been doing something productive, you know. And I see that with all kinds of things, where people are just constantly looking at that screen. They're watching the thing. They're doing this thing on social. They're commenting, they're chatting, they're doing whatever. And it's just a huge waste of time at times.
Yeah.
It can be a good thing, but it can be a huge waste of time.
Yeah, and a lot of activism going on, you know. And on the upside, a lot of humor, and you can get a lot of fun stuff out there. But, and I tell you what, you know, Mark went on vacation and got off. I actually decided to get off Twitter. So I've been off Twitter for about a month. And, yeah, I'm a happier person for that.
Yeah.
So that's why none of our Gospel Rain audience
has
been seeing anything on Twitter.
Because
you dropped
kind of stuff.
You're off Twitter. Well, just go to Facebook. You'll find us there.
One of the issues we, as pastors, I'm sure you guys get frustrated with this, is I see people retweeting some really bad theology.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
So it's you just went back and go, are you serious? I mean, do you really believe that well enough now that you've just spread that to 1,500 other people?
Yeah.
And infected them with that same terrible theology, and that comes from so many different directions.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, everybody believes, if you see it out there three times, surely it must be true.
Yeah.
And that I think that's damaging as well. We used to get our bad theology in smaller doses.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're getting it in much larger doses, much faster, more.
And we're not that far into the social media thing. Just imagine how this is going to evolve 5 years, 10 years from now, how it's going to balloon and get bigger. We're not all that far into this thing, so it's amazing where we can end up with this thing.
Yeah, I'd like to, and so this is an experiment in many ways, communication experiment, and it's changing. There'll be something new, Snapchat today, something else tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, but so the next generation is pushing us into, as one writer said, these are digital natives. The whole world is different for my kids than it was for me. I mean, they've grown up in it. And so, you know, the millennial generation and later, they're a unique kinds of issues in the church now. And maybe if I could throw some things your way, Mark, on a multi-generational discussion. You're a You're not a boomer, are you?
I am a boomer.
You're a boomer. Okay.
I made it. Barely.
You made it. I made it. I'm a Gen Xer.
Yeah.
Matt, yes. Gen Xer. We're the lost generation,
yeah.
Two of us.
Yeah. Bless our hearts.
But we're close. I mean, we're close to the so I was born in 75, and they kind of start millennials at 80. So I'm kind of – we're close to that. But at the same time, that has produced some interesting dynamics in the church, especially the established church, when you have – when you have builders, boomers, a little bit of Gen Xers, but a lot of millennials on social issues in particular.
Right.
So you raised the issue of the election, but just in general, cultural discussions around racism, immigration, refugees, gender, transgenderism, homosexuality, and how generations view those conversations and how they lean in. Can you speak to that from a pastor's point of view as we're preaching the text and we're trying to relate to different generations on a variety of things? I mean, we're looking at people they don't even agree on how to even get into those conversations, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. So for those that are sitting in front of me on a Sunday morning, those that are, I would say, serious about their relationship to Christ, so you've got a group of builders out there, the older generation, then you've got boomers that kind of came in behind them, you guys and then millennials. And I'd say there are people in each of those generations, obviously, that are serious about their faith, really are followers of Christ. But there's a difference in how they look through the lens to see those social issues and how to deal with those. And a lot of that has to do with, for example, I think older boomers and builders, they came along about Roe v. Wade was kind of in their early adulthood, and so that is the issue. And that became the lightning rod for everything in that generation, and it is critical. I mean, it is sad what we have done.
And it affected our generation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, exactly, yeah. That's why there's not as many of you guys.
Yeah, that's right.
But then you've got coming in behind that some other social issues. And it just happens to be that in terms of politics, especially, those two issues kind of tend to fall in two different camps in terms of how you go about handling those things from a biblical perspective. And so I've watched young adults, my girl's age, look at it from one direction. And I watch folks my dad's age, my mom's age, look at it from a different direction. And it's caused some real conflicts in the church. And I do think going forward, it's one of the things that we are going to wrestle with in terms of how do we handle this as pastors. That's a big deal, because I've got people who, apart from some of the social issues, let's take immigration as an example, where you've got a generation that basically is saying just can't accept certain people into our country. Then you've got another generation who's saying, you got to be kidding. As Christians, we not only accept them, we embrace them, and we are going to help them. And when you sit down and talk to both of them separately, you can kind of keep the issue calm and the conversation calm. But when you put those in the same room, it is a real emotional. It's an emotional lightning rod there. And they just don't view that through the same lens. And we've got to get them back to the first question about this gospel-centeredness.
Right.
We've got to get them back to how does the gospel apply in each of those situations? And yet, then you're left with, I don't really have a good choice in terms of my politics or my candidates and that kind of thing. But as a pastor, you stand between those two.
Right.
That's what's difficult. If I were not a pastor, I could declare one position and be, you know, just go with it and be hot with it. And some do that are pastors that do that. But you just got to be very careful and how you approach each of those sides of that issue.
Let me ask you this. Maybe it's a little finer point on what you're saying, because I'm seeing this idea increasingly divisive in the church, and that's the issue of what is patriotism, and I guess maybe American nationalism, if that's a right phraseology. Here's what I mean. I see older generation much quicker to, you know, be protective of American patriotism. Younger generation, not so much. I mean, it seems to me that it's a different take altogether on what an American is for older generation and younger generation, how we define ourselves and what that looks like. And, you know, 4th of July always comes around and, you know, do you have a patriotic service or not? And one of the things recently that caused me so much distress on Twitter was just listening to so many people just absolutely bash, you know, folks that might have some kind of patriotic service in their church. And I just thought, man, is this where we are?
You know?
And I understand the gospel conversation, but
sat on both sides of that. And again, you got to realize where you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're in the deep South and you're ministering to a generation that is older, there's a real struggle there. They've been through wars.
That's right.
Most of us look at and say, we've never been through one of those.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't really know what it is to have my faith challenged in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And to have my freedoms challenged in that way or any of that. And so they see from one perspective. And then you've got a generation, again, my kids' age, my daughter's ages, that they've never been through a war. They sort of remember pretty well 9/11, but didn't really get that as being a war so much. And so balancing that in a church is difficult. And yeah, I've seen the same thing in bashing churches that have, you know, patriotic services versus churches that don't do anything at all in that regard. And so I think Jimmy Scroggins actually recently wrote a blog on that. And presented probably the most balanced view of that. So I'd recommend people go check that out and see what Jimmy said.
We might get a link
it.
Out to that if we
yeah,
can find
we
it.
Do that. Yeah. Let me, speaking of generational things, I know it can be difficult as a pastor. You're preaching, and especially if you have a multi-generational church.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with people who, like you said, who've fought the wars and were raised in time of war, and then some of our younger people don't even know who was fighting who. And so that you're really speaking to, I mean, two just total opposites, two different poles of people who understand at least American history and where Christianity intersects with our American history, and that means different things to different people.
Yeah, it does.
And so as a pastor, that can be difficult when you're trying to communicate certain things. But again, you keep going back to Mark, and I appreciate that you keep going back to the first thing that we talked about was. Mm-hmm. Gospel clarity. And I think if we're clear about that, the gospel applies across all generations, no matter the issue they're dealing with, the gospel can bring clarity to that issue. And that's where we as pastors need to bring that to bear constantly on our congregations, is the gospel more than we do the issue. You know, and we can become so divided over issues, but the gospel is what really matters. That's what's going to unify the body of Christ.
Yeah, and I think as pastors, that's our responsibility is stay, and I heard this term, read this term, I guess, from John Piper, stay tethered to the text.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I teach the text, be very careful in your applications of things and how you say it and whether or not you're really trying to play to your audience,
right?
Or am I really trying to apply this to life? And so one of the ways I've tried to handle not only these issues that can be controversial, but even theological issues that can be controversial, sometimes you just got to point blank say, hey, this is three different ways this can be looked at, and this is what I believe. But the other side of that is to stay tethered to that text and just say what the text says.
Mm-hmm.
Stay with that. Be careful on your applications, and let the Holy Spirit do some of that for you.
That's good. Let me, while we're in this generational vein, let me ask you about something else. We know right now that millennials don't, at least statistically, don't tend to give as much when we talk about giving, tithing, giving to the church, giving through the church ministry, as much as our builders and boomers have and still are, but we're quickly losing that older generation who are, I guess, statistically are our biggest givers even still in many churches.
Right.
And then now we're going to end up, our millennials are inheriting positions of leadership in churches where they're not really invested. And that can be a big issue. Speak to that as a pastor. Where do you see us headed down the road as we look at the issue of giving?
Well, that's a great question. Don't know if your listeners have read the book, The Great Evangelical Recession, by John Dickerson. It's one of the areas
we've referred to it. I've read it recently.
One of the things that he brings up in that book is this very idea. I think it's going to be interesting to watch it play out. And I know he's talking about giving in terms of per capita giving, percent of income giving, and that kind of stuff. And so maybe it is low. I wouldn't be surprised, because we've been so scared to talk about money in our churches.
Right.
Again, I hate to keep coming back to this, but how does the gospel speak to that,
right,
in terms of God's ownership of everything that I have versus, oh, I may tip God a little bit of my money.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been afraid to address that, mm-hmm, number one. And I think it does come back to, again, it's a discipleship issue. Mm-hmm. Are we going to teach this generation or not? And I believe there's enough. I believe that the millennials that are coming into the kingdom are so strong about their faith because they're having to come in swimming upstream much more than we did as we came to Christ. Because the culture for my generation, as we came to Christ, we were pretty much swimming downstream.
Yeah.
It wasn't that difficult. Now, if you come to Christ, not saying we're being persecuted in America like they have in other countries, but the culture is coming against us.
Yeah, they're challenging the faith.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I don't know long term. I don't know if there will be as many millennials in American churches as there are builders in American churches. But I think the per capita giving is going to be interesting to watch. But we're going to have to address this as a discipleship issue. I also believe millennials, as you get them involved in serving, as they plug into things, as you get them on the mission field, there are some aha moments when they begin to think, wow, so in order to fund this, I'm gonna have to do something.
Now, are we saying that millennials largely don't give, period, because they don't have disposable income? Or are we saying, because I mean, Kickstarter campaigns abound, and you know, we can throw our money at, you know, $600 iPhone and all this other kind of stuff. Are we talking specifically for the church and the ministry of the church as a matter of discipleship giving? Or are they just, they're just not giving?
I don't know. I think our older generations were and have and still are committed to the corporate church body, their local church, building that. And I know of a number of older generation who have taken such ownership of that it can go to the negative. This is my church.
Right, I
paid for this church. That kind of, but at least there is some ownership of that. And I don't know that we see that as much with our millennials. A lot of it is come and go. Mm-hmm. You know, if I don't have anything better to do, I'll go to church. Mm-hmm. And I've got a list of things to do. And I'm going to get to church. I'm going to get there. But and when I get there, I'll give. Mm-hmm. But I may not be there. We just didn't see that, I don't think, with our older generation. It was a real strong commitment to the local body of the church.
Well, and they were accustomed to building institutions in this country. That's where the institutions were built, by this builder generation coming in after World War II. And so they don't really have a problem with giving to a church, letting the church function. Whether it's committees or elders or whoever's making decisions, to let that body function as they have chosen to do. The millennials, that just hasn't been their thing. They're not institution builders, and we look a lot like an institution a lot of times as a church.
You know, it's going to purify the church, I think, in some respect. We hear demographically about the rise of the nuns, you know, that they're just no affiliation. They have none when it comes to religious affiliation of any kind. Even in America, in a post-Christian kind of sense, that they're not even identifying as Christian. Which for the older generation, I'm a Christian. I was born and raised a Christian. I'll always be a Christian. But fighting upstream, I like that. I like that metaphor. That, you know, we need to pray for this generation that they can carry the gospel banner, you know, ahead. And maybe it's not the institutionalism of a previous generation, but that the health and life and mission of the church, you know, flourishes, and that they have the kind of buy-in that you're talking about, Matt, ownership of that as we pass a baton on to them.
And I would even say that the millennials that are involved in the churches that I've pastored, the millennials that are involved seem to be really sold out to the gospel. Right. And they're very, they want to be gospel-centered. They want to have a biblical worldview and act out of that biblical worldview, not a traditional worldview. Yeah. And so I would say of the millennials, there may be fewer of them right now, but the ones that are in, they're all in. And that is a great encouragement for this next generation and where the kingdom is headed.
Absolutely. That's good. Well, let me tie up our podcast. Mark's been fantastic discussion. I hope this has helped. And a lot of the things, and I'll just point our listeners back, a lot of the things that we have mentioned here on this podcast, we've referenced in previous podcasts. So you can go back and look at the website, look at iTunes, that kind of thing. You can scroll through and find some of the topics that we've talked about before that may have touched on some of these issues like giving or some of those other things. So we encourage our listeners to go back there. So as I tie up this podcast, let me close with a segment that we like to do. One of the segments that we like to do on Gospel Reign is a segment called Did You Know? And this gives us an opportunity to ask a question and then give an answer for our listening audience, of give them some information that we may or may not care to know. All right. So, and Mike is good at this. Mike gives us all kinds of stupid information that nobody ever wants to know. And so I'm going to start with Mike, and Mark, we're going to give you a chance to go. I'm going to forego mine because I'm the one talking now. But Mike, give us a did you know, some nugget of information that we all might.
Well, you know, I have a Polynesian background. My family are Samoan. Not that that means anything, but I like macadamia nuts. I like pineapple, coconut, all that stuff is probably because I come from Polynesian descent.
So how much Samoan are you?
I'm a quarter Samoan. My mother's half and her father full.
Samoan. Wow. Okay. All right.
So anyways, but the point, did you know that macadamia nuts are toxic to dogs? So don't feed.
Are you kidding?
I'm serious. It will kill them, all of them, canines.
I did not know that.
So don't let them get a hold of macadamia nuts, man.
Man, I'm glad you told me. I got three dogs, man. Yeah. I didn't know
Don't spill them out on the floor, man.
My wife is a dog lover, and I am not. And so
you just got some ideas, huh?
I'll just keep her off of this podcast and keep that in mind.
That's right. Just keep it in mind for the neighbor's dog.
Exactly.
All right, Mark, you got a did you know?
All right. So I am, as Micah said in the introduction, I live in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. And a lot of the listeners may not know, Mount Juliet is a suburb of Nashville. Nashville is now considered one of, if not the it city. We have 100 people a day moving into Nashville. But did you know the average American lives in one of the top 50 metropolitan areas in our country? 54% of those who are American, those living in America, live in one of the top 50 metropolitan cities. So so we live
that's
near
remarkable.
Nashville. It is. Tons of folks.
So Nashville Metro, how many people?
We're at about 1,000,000, 2, 3, four, something like that now. And, you know, the thing is, you're starting to see that spread happening.
Interesting.
And within 2 or 3 miles of our church, we got 6 or 7 subdivisions that are just now under development. So it is booming in Nashville. You can see cranes for miles.
This is a dumb question, but is that in part due to population growth, or is that just people relocating to bigger place? You know what I'm saying? Is that a dumb question?
No, it's not a dumb question.
I just don't know. I mean, I don't know.
There's
the
a
answer.
Lot of well, I know industries in Nashville, right?
In Nashville, yes. We got several big industries. So you have medical industry, a lot of folks in the medical field. You have the music, which is what we're known for more than anything else. Have a lot of tourism now because of the music industry.
Interesting.
We now in Nashville, we are the most expensive hotel rooms in America.
Wow.
More
no
expensive
way.
Than New York City. Absolutely,
Son,
man.
I
so,
didn't know that.
That's wild.
So all the country is coming to town now in Nashville, and we're enjoying watching all the people move in. It is a very international city. We are somewhere around 134, 135 people groups now in Davidson County, which is where Nashville is.
Yeah, and I heard actually largest Kurdish population
exactly
outside of
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
In the United States.
In the United States.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So the nations have come to
the
Nashville.
The nations have come to Nashville.
Wow. Yep. That's incredible. Well, that's good. We didn't know. I didn't know. So there you go. Well, it's been fun on the Gospel Rain podcast today. We hope you'll check us out on our website, on go to Facebook, go to Twitter, which Micah is not on anymore, and go to some other places, iTunes. You can find us there. And we just ask you to share our podcast with other people. But it's been great being with you today. We'll see you back next time on Gospel Rain.
Thank you for joining us for the Gospel Rain podcast. We hope you've been encouraged today, and we pray the gospel will reign in your life this week. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or check out our website at gospelrain.com.